So, let me introduce our speaker, Christine Morse.
Thanks. Good evening. The word lecture has sort of almost frightened me out of doing this talk. It's going to be just, you know, an introduction, and then really it'll be up to you. So there we are. There's a bit of noise from the street, so if you can't hear me, do say. Right, it's very unpleasant to hear. So, what then exactly does terrorism mean? What is it about? Well, you may think that this is a daft question to you or I or the average person in the street. It probably means that a bomb has exploded somewhere, maybe in one of the big shops in London. Quite a lot of material damage has been done. Some people have been injured, perhaps some people have been killed. Or perhaps it means that a plane has been hijacked and the people in the plane are suddenly taken hostages and some terrorists are making demands on some government, and that's the sort of thing. Whatever, it's a story of violence. It can be a kidnapping, it can be a shooting, a murdering, bombs. Sometimes it's violence inflicted on the terrorists themselves, and we hear of hunger strikes, suicides. But it is never violence for the sake of it, as, for instance, violence on the terraces, or just people, you know, going crazy in the street after drinking too much. Nor is it violence for personal gain. No. It's violence of a special kind, violence with a political aim. Now, what is the accepted definition of terrorism? I mean, what do they say? What do the authorities say? What do the dictionaries say? Well, interestingly enough, they say nothing. They haven't been able to agree on a definition of terrorism, not for lack of people getting together and studying and talking about it and all that. There's been plenty of committees. People from all over the world have got together and tried, but no, they can't agree on a definition. Why? Well, I've got my own little explanation, which is that terrorist acts, that is, acts of violence to frighten and intimidate the opposition and get your own way, basically, are acts that are perpetrated all the time by states themselves. So my own little definition of terrorism is this. All the thugs, gunmen and murderers who do not support this particular state. And you may think that I'm being flippant now about this, and so I shall read you a quote. In the words of the fighters for Free Croatia, who hijacked a plane in September 1977, and this is what they said. We expect all peace-loving forces in the world to describe us as terrorists, criminals, and murderers. From the time of Caesar through Hitler, Stalin, Franco, and Salazar, as well as with numerous other colonial and neocolonial governments, those fighting for national liberation have always been described in such terms. One man's terrorist, is another man's patriot, depending solely on one's national and political objectives and suitability. The point to be made here, obviously, is not to conclusively define terrorism, an impossible task, but rather to explain the ultimate necessity for our extreme decision and to ask others to judge this decision objectively and unemotionally. We must remember that today's terrorists are often tomorrow's policymakers, having participated in the formation of a new, independent state. Thus, the unsuccessful continue to be terrorists, but, upon success, are courted by all governments. With this reality reappearing dependably from one day to the next, all ethical and moral revulsion felt for so-called terrorist acts is necessarily irrational. Well, I'll come back to the last sentence later on in the talk. But for the time being, what I want to say is that what comes out clearly from this quote is that there is no great distinction between insurgent terrorism and state terrorism. The two are closely linked. And so the first distinction I'm making then in this short study of terrorism is to distinguish between state terrorism and insurgent terrorism. State terrorism is something we don't normally talk about very much, but still, it definitely exists. And there are two ways, I think, that states use terrorism. They use terrorism on countries outside their own borders. And I'll just give two examples, but there are plenty more that you can think of. One is Russia. I mean, the way Russia terrorizes all the countries around to keep them where she wants them. And another example is what the Germans did to Norway just before invading Norway. They showed films to Norwegian officials, films that had been prepared by a special propaganda committee, showing the invasion of Poland with lots and lots of German tanks and lots of troops and all that. And very quickly, the Norwegians capitulated. So this clearly worked. It was terrorism. Now, states also use terrorism within their own borders against the population inside their own countries. And I'll now look at three different types of countries: dictatorships, state capitalist countries, and Western democracies. Well, I think that if we look at dictatorships, it's very obvious that they use terrorism. They use nothing else, in fact. Think of Latin American countries, some African countries, Iran, Hitler's Germany, etc. They keep people where they want them by using terror. State capitalist countries, such as Russia and Eastern European countries generally, are a bit more subtle about it, but still, basically the principle is the same. If people deviate from the line set down by the government, by the state, they're quickly sent off to labor camps or mental asylums, etc. And it is really through terror that people are kept where they are. Now, lastly, Western democracies, such as England or France. Most of the people, I think, who live here would say, well, there's no terrorism here. I mean, this is a free country. It's a democratic country. I mean, the state doesn't use terror against us. Rubbish. But we must remember that the police and the army are ever present. They're there all the time. The minute there's any trouble, like a strike, like the miners' strike, or in France in 1968 when the students started demonstrating, or when there's a march here, even a peaceful march, there's a CND march, something like that, they're there. They're there to break the strikes, to threaten demonstrators, and generally intimidate people and just remind us that we should be afraid of them. And the states administer terror. They administer terror. They've got special groups of people, like the Special Patrol Group in this country, the CRS in France. They've got intelligence services. They've got immigration controls, information controls. Terror is administered, there's no doubt about it. What is the aim of using terror against the population inside the country? Well, it is basically to get people to do what the state wants, to keep them working, to force them to accept laws that are not in their interest, to stop them disrupting the smooth running of society. And another strong weapon used in this process is, or are, the media. And if you don't think that the media is a weapon of terrorism, just listen to what some UNESCO experts said. They got together at a meeting in 1978, and this is what came out of it. Today, too many of the ideas circulated in society are simply deposited in the minds of the majority and deliberately elaborated as products to be consumed by an anonymous mass of consumers and not dialoguers. In this way, too many peoples have been denied their right to speak their word and are submitted to a violence which, without being physical, is as dehumanizing as physical aggression itself. So this is why I included the media in amongst the weapons used by the state. So how does terrorism work then, state terrorism? Well, it works, I think, through a combination of fear and manipulation of people's thinking. And if you look at the different types of states I've just mentioned, the three types, it ranges from using mainly fear, as in dictatorships, with little manipulation of people's thinking, to using mainly manipulation of our thinking, as here, with just background fear. Now, let's look again at insurgent terrorism. Does it work in the same way as state terrorism? And I would say yes, it does. By perpetrating violent, arbitrary acts of terrorism, the terrorists cause fear amongst the population, and fear and disorientation. And then by using very spectacular violence, sometimes with quite a lot of suspense, the terrorists gain access to the media, just like the state used the media. And so, once they frighten people, it's much easier to influence them, and they get terrific audiences sometimes in the Munich Olympic Games in 1972, when the Palestinians got in and took the Israeli hostages, they had an audience of something like 800 million people watching. I mean, it's not always like that, but they get vast audiences. And people do identify with them, although you might think that they would identify, you know, they would be revulsed by the violence. Very often, they also identify with the terrorist. The cause appeals to them because of their own dissatisfactions, their own emotions, their own prejudices. They suddenly see that as something worthwhile and they say, yes, you know, that's right. And I'll read you a quote by some Palestinians. And this is what they said. The first several hijackings aroused the consciousness of the world and awakened the media and world opinion much more and more effectively than 20 years of pleading at the United Nations. And they also, one of them also said, we would throw roses if it would work, but roses don't get you in the media. So then state terrorism and insurgent terrorism, I would argue, work more or less in the same way. So in what way then are they different? Well, I see the main difference being that state terrorism or state violence is hushed up, it's played down, it's never publicised. Whereas terrorism gets all the headlines and the coverage. And this is because the image of the state is not and must not be that of an oppressor, but that of a protector. And the forces of law and order must be seen by the ordinary citizen, by you and I, as forces that are there to protect us against various dangers, including terrorism. The terrorists, by attacking the general public, try to weaken this image and show that the state is incapable of protecting its own citizens. And the state will then lose its credibility with the people, and the terrorists may appear as viable political alternatives. So, we now see that the state and terrorists are often simply rivals, after the very same thing, power. And the main difference between them is that some are in power and some are not. And that's why their tactics are slightly different, or their politics, if you like. Now, having said this, I want to look a bit more closely at insurgent terrorism itself, because there are different types of insurgent terrorism. And I've made my own little classification. I mean, there are lots of books about terrorism and they all have different classifications, so I've made my own. And perhaps, you know, you will come up with other suggestions after. But I see four types. Social revolutionary, ethnic, nationalist or separatist, anarchist, and violent protest. And now I'll come back to the four types and say what they're about. The social revolutionary terrorists have as their aim to gain state power, basically, and to revolutionize society. Examples, some Latin American countries, there's a map there, and in fact in the New Internationalist, and the map of all over the world of all, you know, terrorists doing that, trying to gain power and change society. Cuba is another one, Russia is another one. And very often, those revolutions are done in the name of socialism, not always, but very often. Or at least in the name of the people or of a better, more equal society. So we'll come back to that use of socialism later. The second type, ethnic, nationalist or separatist, has basically the same aim, to gain power. But this time, from a foreign ruler and establish local rule instead of foreign rule. Examples, Israel, today the Palestinians, Algeria, Cyprus, Ireland, and today, the Basque country, ITA, and the Bretons in France, and the Welsh to some extent. They get their support from the population, not in the name of socialism, but in the name of the nation, or the language, which creates a bond between the people there. The third type of insurgent terrorism is anarchist terrorism, and in fact that was really what started it in the 19th century. The Russian anarchists started terrorism with their idea of propaganda by the deed. You know, the best way to sort of put your views forward to the masses is through violent action that then make them think. Their aim is not to gain power, because anarchists don't want states anyway. Their aim is to smash the state, to criticize society, and to hopefully provoke uprisings from the discontented masses. And examples of those are the Russian anarchist in the 19th century, the Narodnoye Volya, the Angry Brigades in England in the 60s, and the Red Brigades in Italy, another example, although the Red Brigades are not anarchists in their theory, but their methods are very close. They're not really out for power, they're out to destroy the state and to destroy society as it exists in their country. The fourth type are called violent protest, and I would say that this very often comes out of despair on the part of the people who perpetrate the deeds. They don't criticize so much the whole of society as take issue on one or two things about which they feel very strongly. Examples, the Baader-Meinhof group in Germany, who were very set against the Vietnam War and also after Third World Hunger. And another example, you may remember the Symbionese Liberation Army, who kidnapped Patricia Hearst in California, in America. And they were protesting about poverty and injustices, and they made Patricia's daddy give lots and lots of food to the poor. So those are the four types of insurgent terrorism that I can see. And what do they lead to? Well, types one and two, who aim for power, basically lead to a new dictator or a new ruling class. And for the man or woman in the street, basically nothing changes. Type three, the anarchist type, invariably lose against the state. They're just not good enough, not strong enough to attack the state. Type four has the same fate. They lose out against the state or destroy themselves. The Baader-Meinhof group, they all eventually committed suicide. Some died on hunger strikes and the rest committed suicide. So how successful is terrorism by its own standards? When it comes to gaining power, sometimes it works. Particularly if the countries are poor and unstable. But it doesn't always work. The Palestinians are still at it, for instance. To attack the state, it doesn't work. No chance. It just leads to the self-destruction of the organization. And now, for the last thing that they also aim at, which is communication. They say, you know, we want to shock people into thinking. Does that work? Well, they get publicity, and they can change people's thinking, as the Palestinians said. You know, they can make people aware of a cause. But I would say that it's not really thinking. It's an emotional form of communication. The people will identify with a cause that appeals to them. They'll hear something like, we want a land of our own. We want the foreign invader out. People shouldn't be dying in the Vietnam War. And, you know, it sort of grips you, and you think, yes, that's right, you know, in spite of the violence that they've perpetrated. So it is an emotional thing, and because it's an emotional thing, it can work against them. The people can just be completely revulsed and disgusted by the killing of innocent victims and by the method used, and they can be put off not only terrorism but revolution and social change generally. So it can have a very negative effect. And indeed, on the whole, I think it would be fair to say that terrorists do not appear to be very clear thinkers. They tend to be people of action. There's an element of ecstasy in the terrorist act, an element of pleasure, of achievement, whatever. And they don't really sit down so much and think. Right. Well, this is the end now of my sort of objective study of terrorism. I've looked at it. I've set the two types, state terrorism and insurgent terrorism, and within insurgent terrorism, there are again different types. Some aim at gaining power, some aim at just criticizing society and destroying it. But I don't want to stop here, and what I want to do now, because my own position is not to just look at various phenomena in society and say, oh, well, there they are, and that's how it is, and, you know, that's the end of it. No, my personal aim, and that of the people in the SPGB, is to understand society and then possibly to change it. I mean, not by ourselves, obviously, but to move towards change. So what I'm going to try to do now is to answer three questions. And this is now as a socialist. The first question is, what does terrorism tell me about this society? And the second question is, what does terrorism tell me about socialism? And the third one is, what does terrorism tell me about changing society? and in the process of changing society, getting rid of terrorism, getting rid of violence. So, the first question, what does it tell me about this society? Well, what came out of my study, and my own conclusions now about terrorism, are that aspiring rulers resort to violence because they know that ruling is in fact done by force and violence. That's the name of the game. And so they play. And the state appears clearly as an instrument of coercion and not so much of protection as we are led to believe. Why? Why is this? Why do governments have to keep such a tight rein on the people they govern? Is it because people are unruly, bad, lazy, uncooperative, incapable of organizing and running things without being made to? This is what we're subtly made to believe. We need the state to protect us and make sure that we do what is for our own good. So, is the present system for our own good? Let's look at it. We work all the time, yet we're short of everything all the time. We live in countries which we could call our own, yet nothing there belongs to us. We have no say whatsoever in the running of society, no part in decision making. Our environment is being polluted, yet we're powerless. We have to live under the threat of a nuclear war, nuclear annihilation, yet we're powerless. So, although we're a lot more sophisticated than our primitive forebears, who lived under the control of natural forces, we're no more powerful to shape our own lives than they were, possibly less so. So, back to the question, is this all for our own good? Clearly it isn't. But, there are a few people in this society who are in a slightly different position. They do not have to work, yet they're short of nothing, including time. In their countries, everything belongs to them. Land, factories, buildings, everything. They run society through the government. They don't even have to do the work themselves. They can escape pollution by living in nice places, kept fresh and clean. And they have some control over war and the army. Some, not complete control. These people are a tiny, tiny minority. So, clearly, they need a fairly strong coercive machinery to keep things as they are. And this is why states are coercive and violent. The majority of us have been dispossessed of everything, and we're kept in that state under threat. And that is also why we have rivalries between different minorities. That is the incentive for minority action. If a small minority can do this to the vast majority, to all the masses, then of course other minorities are going to think we could do it as well, we just have to take power. And that's the cause of the rivalries and the wars between minorities. You try and discredit the present rulers, you attack them, you weaken them in whatever way you can, and then you take their place. So, this is what terrorism tells me about society. That's how society works. And that's why terrorism has a place in it. It's a society based on the violent rule of a minority at the expense of the vast, vast majority of us. And as such, it will always be open to violent attacks from other minorities. So now, what does terrorism tell me about socialism? I mean, as I said before, a lot of terrorism has happened in the name of socialism. And invariably, it has led to either totalitarian states, or to state capitalism, and whatever the name of the new government or the new system, for the people who live in that country, it has meant violence, oppression, and hardship. The violent protest kind of the anarchist and violent protest kind of terrorism has been done also, if not in the name of socialism, at least in the name of a better society, of a more peaceful society, etc. So, I'll just now quickly define what I mean by socialism and what we all mean by socialism in the Socialist Party of Great Britain, because we mean something quite different from what a lot of people mean when they use that word. At the moment, people organize to produce things. Well, that's what a society is. People who get together to produce things. And the way we do it today is that we produce lots and lots and lots of things. There's no shortage, but we produce them for profit so that they will be sold. And then these profits don't belong to us, they belong to the owners of the world. And in socialism, what would happen is that people would work as they do today, well, not exactly as they do, but they would go on producing things, but instead of producing them for sale and profit, they would produce them for use. So we would go on building houses and making bread and all that, and then we would just take what we needed, all of us. And there would be no money, and there would be no profits, no capital accumulation, nothing like that. The society would be democratic. That is, everybody would take part in decision making. Now, you may think that today we live in a democratic society. What we do today is that we elect a couple of people or more, and then they do all the decision making. We don't do any of it at all. I mean, think of it in terms of going on holiday. Think of going on holiday with a group of friends, 10 of you. And when you, before you start the holiday, you elect one of them. And from then on, that person decides everything. Where you go, how much you spend, what film you go and see, what beach you go on, how long you go sunbathing for. That's what we're doing. No, democracy is about everybody taking part in every decision, everybody having a say, and then voting, and then the decision is carried by the majority. And there, it would be a society without wars, because wars today, well, I can't go into this, but wars today are basically created because of the need to make more and more profits and get to the resources and get to the markets, and so this creates the tensions, and then we get the wars. Right. So that's our, very quickly, that's our definition of socialism. Well, terrorism, in any of its form, never ever stood for that. And quite frankly, I don't think it could, because I really think that there is a link, there is a connection between means and ends. And I come now to this other question, the third question: what does terrorism tell me about changing society? Can violence lead to peace? You know, can you have this? You know, if you want peace, prepare for war. Does that make sense? You know, to me, it just doesn't. It doesn't make sense at all. Can throwing bombs lead to a better understanding of society? Yeah, just about as much as kicking your car in the morning can lead to a better understanding of the engine when it doesn't start. It's the same kind of activity. So, what terrorism is about, it's not really about changing society. It's about manipulating the masses and gaining their support. But socialism is not a matter of support. I mean, this is what we've got to understand. Sometimes when I'm selling the Standard in the street, people stop and say to me, "Ah, but you see, if you stood for this or that, you know, if you agreed with CND, you'd get more support." You don't want support. It's not a matter of support. It's a matter of people deciding what they want and then getting together and then doing it. I don't want anybody's support. I know what I think. So this is the where terrorism can't really have anything to do with socialism, because it's not after making people think or creating thinking generally. It's just after gaining support from people who don't know what they want, except that, you know, they're used to wanting leaders. And there's a final question, which I think is quite interesting. Is, I've just described terrorism. Now, would there be any terrorism in socialism? You know, imagining that we've, you know, that socialism is established by the majority of people. Well, by my definitions of terrorism, there couldn't really be any of the first kind, which is the one where people are trying to gain power from another minority, because there wouldn't be any more minority ruling. So you wouldn't have rival minorities. So I think that that would definitely be out. Now, the kind that might not be out, the anarchist would be out as well, because, I mean, they're after smashing the state, and in terrorism we wouldn't have a state. So that would be out as well. Now, what about acts of protest and despair? Would people who didn't get their way react like that in socialism? Well, it's a bit unpredictable. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, try and say what people would be like in socialism, but, I mean, one can imagine a little bit. For one thing, in a non-violent society, I think violence would not be regarded as a particularly good way of solving problems, and so I don't think people would resort to it. Then, in minority-ruled societies, we have no say at all in the running of things. This leads to a feeling of helplessness and powerlessness, which leads in turn to a great feeling of frustration, and that leads to violence. When you're really so frustrated, you think, yeah, there's nothing you can do, and you just, you know, throw a bomb. And then there's another aspect, and it's the fact that when decisions are made by majorities, the majorities change. So that, you know, on every decision, people will vote, but all the people who vote for one decision are not going to be the same as for another. So what will happen is that sometimes you or I will be in the majority, and sometimes we will be in the minority. And I think we'll accept that as perfectly fair. Think of the holiday example again. You know, you'd accept occasionally not having your way if you knew that on other occasions you would. And you would always, even if you didn't get your way, you would at least get the chance to put every argument that you could think of in favour of what you wanted, which you don't today. So, for all these reasons, I don't think there would be terrorism in socialism, and the final reason why I don't think so, but that's a very personal thing, because I just really like the idea of socialism. I think it would be a really good society. And I think that in that society, human beings would just function so much better than they do today. And so the violence is in a way of showing that all our potential, all the things that we could be, we are not, and it makes us mad, and so we show it violently. So, to conclude this talk, I'd like to come back to, where is it now, my first quotation, if I can find it. With this reality, the fact of terrorists becoming policymakers, reappearing dependably from one day to the next, all ethical and moral revulsion felt for so-called terrorist acts is necessarily irrational. Well, when I first read that, I was a bit taken aback. I thought, wow, you know, how can they say something like that? Then at second reading, I thought, yes, they're right. Of course it is irrational. But what's irrational is not to reject and condemn and be disgusted by acts of terrorism. What's irrational is to condemn some acts of terrorism and not others. So if you are disgusted by terrorism, then you've got to be disgusted by every kind, including state terrorism. And if we're going to do something about terrorism, then it's not indeed in looking at just insurgent terrorism that's going to solve the problem. We've got to look at the whole of society, the whole system, how it works, and decide to get rid of the whole thing, the whole violent thing, and establish instead the sort of society I've described, and that and only that will mean peace. And we can do that, we can change that whole system peacefully. We don't need to do it violently, we can do it very, very simply by using a little piece of paper and putting that in the ballot box.